We're all getting ready for Sesshin at this point, or many of us are. I hope we'll all at least drop in and have a sit at Chikoji this next week, if you can. It's part of our practice here. Let's do introductions around.
Wendy.
Chris.
Daniel.
Max.
Steve.
Myra.
Paul.
Jeffrey.
Yap.
Karin.
Angie. So we're going to enter another piece of Katagiri Roshi tonight. And I've been interested in how different he is from his teaching is from my teacher, even though they practice together at San Francisco Zen Center. He also was brought to San Francisco to help Suzuki Roshi in the very early days. And so the two young Japanese, he's very young in this picture, and like Coben's picture just looks shining and glorious and adorable. And of course, they both have passed away by now as old people. And so it's very interesting for me to, as having gone through that whole process myself, to see these young voices, or this young voice that he's presenting in here. And what this is an accumulation of talks that he gave, which is done by, it doesn't give him credit. And I'm not sure who it is. Andrea Martin has an intro, but the main transcriber, I think, is someone else who is now a big part of Minnesota Zen Center. but in any case, it's divided up into parts, and we've come to part two. Part one was called The Naked Nature of Time. And part two, or it's The Cosmic World of One Moment. The Cosmic World of One Moment. So he continues with that discussion in the second part, but it's called Profound Human Desire. He says, we want to be in the pure and clear state of existence that's always going to be beyond our feelings of attachment and passion and grasping or our ego. We want to be in the state of existence where there's nothing to attach to and all we can do is just be. However, it's really, really hard because wanting it is already grasping. And so we keep going back to the same problem over and over again, feeling that there's something out there, something else that we don't have yet and that we are going to get, but we don't quite know how. And as long as we think so, we're still in that state of grasping. It's still in that state of attachment because we're expecting something outside of ourself. And what he's pointing to is how we become so lost in the idea of inside and outside. There's me. And I'm a problem. And then there's out there. And there's something out there that I can get. that'll make my problem go away. And he's pointing to the truth, the actual truth, that isn't what it is. All the answers are in our question. As soon as you ask it, it's in the question, the answer. He said this leads to deep suffering. Not just the ouch kind of suffering, the broken arm kind of suffering, or even the loss of people we love, but the sense of a profound sadness that there's something missing. Something precious is missing. He says, at the bottom of our suffering, like this, is the transient nature of reality itself. That things are coming and going, coming and going. Nothing stays put. We can't hold anything. So he points out that we think of ourself as separate from everything else. It sure looks like it and it feels like it. We cultivate this whole sense of ourself as a certain kind of personality with a certain kind of history, and we hope we know where we're going and how we're doing that in our life. And yet it keeps changing on us all the time. It keeps slipping away. So even though we think we know, the truth is, in a sense, we have to keep adjusting. We have to keep changing our mind about even the most simple things. And if we don't change our mind about those things, then we do suffer greatly. So Buddha taught that everyone has the capability to go beyond the ordinary body and mind and be fully present in impermanence with the whole body and mind. To let it be like that rather than resisting it. There are a lot of people my age who are trying very hard to look and be young. And it really doesn't work, because if you're old, you're old, and if you're young, you're young. You can't be one kind of thing when you're another. And yet we're doing that all the time in many different ways. In order to protect ourselves, and to distract ourselves from the sense that everything is changing. We do cultivate distraction as much as we can in order to look away, not to notice. He talks about good and bad and right and wrong. He said, we want to hang on to wholesome states of being because we know there are also unwholesome states of being and we don't want to face them. So whatever we do, there's always dissatisfaction. Always something missing. And he says, we feel that dissatisfaction because of time. In the stream of time, our desires and experiences constantly appear and disappear from moment to moment. So there can be no permanent satisfaction. We can never nail it down. was in college, there was a whole wash of aspiration of all the girls I knew to get married. If I only get married, my whole life will be all better. Then I'll be a good person and I'll be completely connected and I've got it all together. And it didn't work. It doesn't work. There isn't anything that is totally going to solve our sense of satisfaction forever and ever. Very odd, isn't it? Very strange. He says, if you could completely shut yourself off from physiological change, if you'd be exactly the same all the time, you would still feel time passing because you have a constantly changing stream of thinking, of consciousness. And you can't really change that. It just goes pouring through us day and night, thinking, thinking, thinking. He says, Buddhism explains this world of change with three fundamental factors of impermanence, origination, extinction, and maintaining. So things begin, we keep them going, and then they disappear. Maintaining means that you accept your life in a basic way. Extinction means it ends. But extinction means death. That means disappearance completely. So he says, if we accept your life in a basic way, with no particular reason, it's just okay. It's fine like this. It's fine like this, too. And tomorrow morning it will be fine also, whatever is happening. But it doesn't satisfy you because simultaneously it falls apart. Whatever you're satisfied with isn't there anymore. You have a good dinner, but it's not going to do you any good when you're hungry for breakfast. He says, yesterday seems like it's completely separate from today. Because there is continuation, you accept your life with hope and make an effort to live every day. On the other hand, you see that today is not yesterday or tomorrow, so you can't say yesterday is continuing to today. Yesterday's gone. Tomorrow hasn't come. Chogyam Trungpa always says, you should not hope for anything. Just live very enthusiastically in the moment you're in. That's all you really know. So human life is very contradictory. And change, he says, is the basis of human life. That we know for sure. So So don't attach yourself to birth or death. Just live right in the middle of the flow of change. Let it go when it goes, and let it come when it comes. Oh, this is the new thing. Oh, where did it go? It's gone. It's a little unnerving in the beginning when we're used to holding on to things tightly. It's a little anxiety provoking to think in this way, because we like to feel like we can nail things down. But once you accept that you can't, it's so much easier. You can breathe just to let it be. And once you let it be, you know what to do much better, without holding on so tightly. He said, even though human life experience of daily life are just a panoramic picture that can never satisfy our desires. Even so, every moment is right in the middle of the whole universe. It takes in everything. Nothing is missing. One of the things Dogen says more than once, there's nothing missing. So the title of the next section is called Fundamental Suffering as Truth. Fundamental suffering. It says, for human beings, we're always thinking about things. We're reflecting on things. Whether we like it or not, suffering is present in our life, because human beings have a consciousness that makes us reflect on things, reflect upon ourselves. Self-reflection makes you think who you are. So we're making up ourselves as we go along. We're thinking ourselves into existence. Oh, this is what I'm like. Oh, this is what I'm like. Interesting. It can be very interesting, kind of scientific. No. Oh, what is she doing? How weird. On the other hand, he says, reflecting, thinking about ourselves deepens our consciousness. If we really start to look, to study, as Dogen says, to study the self, to really try to understand what's happening, what it's based on. Often if we begin to watch our thinking, we begin to see some of the reason that we have the ideas that we have based on our experience. And not all of our ideas are actually quite accurate. We can begin to see that we're carrying a lot of reflections that aren't quite true. Maybe we've been conditioned to think they're true by where we grew up and what people told us. So it's really important to study what we carry within us and try to understand how true it is or isn't. that all by itself deepens our subjectivity, you could say, deepens our experience of our life. He says it actually allows us to go beyond the reality of our daily life. It's truth, the original nature of existence. He says, as we look deeper and deeper, we do see our suffering. And there's a kind of poignance in it and a beauty in it that's very, very touching. Human life itself is a very touching process. And we're all in it together. Because of suffering, he says, you can learn something. To learn is not to get something from an object that's separate from you. To learn is to be one with truth itself. Consciously or unconsciously, you come back, you rebound. You touch the truth that's always present in the depth of yourself. And then he says, you bounce, you come back. So, it's, he says, it's a funny thing to say, but your life is like a big bottle. All you have to do is fill this empty bottle with wisdom. How? Constantly try to realize the depth of human life. Accept the fact that whatever you do, wherever you live, under all circumstances, you have a chance to realize the truth. With sincerity, try to realize the ultimate nature of your actions. Bowing, studying, talking, whatever it is that you do, we ourselves are action itself. We are what we do. We're not our ideas, we are our enactment. When you bow in gassho, when you bow in gassho, just do it. Just do it through and through. If you really do it, you can touch this ultimate truth. Artists know this. You begin to loosen up your sense of yourself and just do what you do without being self-conscious. If you're not self-conscious, things flow. You don't hold on to some idea about how you're supposed to do it. You just do it. And he says that gassho helps people and deepens your life. And he says, then you bounce back into your ordinary thinking and your ordinary life. So he says we lead a very bouncy kind of existence. That when we drop our sense of self and just enact whatever we are doing, just become an action rather than a person with an idea of who we are, that's one kind of existence. But then we bounce into, oh, but this is me, and I wonder what they think about me, and I wonder where I'm going next, and what I'm going to have for dinner, and etc., etc. Our mind is so amazing, is capable of both And that's what Buddha brought to tell us, that there's more to our thinking than the superficial, self-contained, and self-conscious life that we think of as me. There's more to this. So he ends by talking about touching the present moment and the deep sense of being a human being. He says, interdependence is not the usual idea of relationship. It is a place where everything is empty and interconnected beyond human speculation. So, it's a dynamic existence. It's happening all the time. And the causes and the conditions that go into every moment are determining how this moment is. But we can't hold it because there's the next moment right away after that. So in a way, we're at the mercy of time. In another way, we are time itself. We are self. Our being is time. And that's what Dogen brought to us. Being time. So I think that's enough. And you might have things to add. Jeffrey?
Angie, where are you ending? Just
so I know. I'm ending
page
52.
52. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. There's a couple of questions I do have to ask. So he uses an expression called spiritual security. And I was wondering if you'd like to talk about that.
He talks about that in terms of faith somewhere. It's about trust. It's just about trust. That's really the most crucial thing. The essence of our life is trusting our life itself.
Do you find, as a teacher who has listened to many people in your Sangha, that that's a problem for many practitioners, perhaps initially, is not trust in the universe and not enough faith?
Not trusting oneself also. Actually feeling very risky about everything. And often people don't like themselves very much. I find that they don't trust themselves, they don't like themselves, they're mad at themselves when they make a mistake. Like they should be perfect. So a big part of it is just learning how to accept how imperfect we are. Our own imperfection is our perfection. And to come to appreciate that. You know, if you put yourself in a novel, you'd make a wonderful subject. Each one of you would be fantastic. Some of the good parts and some of the bad parts, and it would be really, really interesting. But we want to polish ourselves up and be better than that. We want to be perfect. And there is no such thing. No such thing.
I had a second question.
Yes.
That was one that I think is, I've never heard this before. It was Kanudoko, which is the way of rapport. And he talks about his experience of pecking from within and the teacher pecking from without.
Yes.
Would you like to talk about that?
That's a wonderful image. Trying to connect is a very tricky business, because in Zen, it's not about relationship exactly, although it feels like it's about relationship. If you connect with somebody else, if you're a student connecting with your teacher, for instance, there is a depth of connection that happens if both sides allow it. If both sides let it happen. So it's not a thought thing. It's not a determined thing. It's just what happens between. It's really in the between that it happens. And the image is the student is in the shell, like a chick is in a shell, and the hen pecks at the shell as the baby is pecking from the inside. So you're both working at creating that connection. And it's a very wonderful thing when it happens. And it's something that happens with a blade of grass or a rock or a star. Any one that you meet. A great place to meet it is in babies. Babies are doing it already. So, unlike a chick, they don't even have a shell. So that connection can easily be made.
As the metaphor, is that very similar for you in Kobe?
Yes. Yes. It's scary and wonderful. Yeah. Maybe you all know it too. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Paul?
I've experienced something like a TV. I was working on a question. Something has been bothering me, and I was trying to figure it out, and at one point I gave it up. And I was watching some program on TV, I don't even know what it was, but someone there said, duh, and it was exactly what I needed. And I just went, oh, thank you. The universe is actually very small.
It's talking to us all the time. We just don't pay attention most of the time. That's beautiful.
Hasn't happened again.
No, probably not. Yeah.
Thanks. I was reading some other work from Dogen in Moon in a Dewdrop.
Mm-hmm.
And so it struck me how intense he was about the harshness of practice, and referred to the Zen master without an arm,
yes,
for example.
Yes.
And he also referred to Buddha himself, you know, doing his like torture for 6 years before he actually decided to sit. And so I was just kind of thinking about, we really just sit. And it is hard, but you know, that we kind of skip the whole hard part that Buddha did 6 years, you know, and I'm not planning to cut my arm either. So I was just kind of wondering about that.
A lot of people wonder about that, but yeah. But he also lived like a king, or a king's child, who was totally spoiled for his whole childhood and his early adulthood as well. And he's not recommending that either. I mean, the tapas practice is something that I think everybody goes through, and some go through it harder than others, depending on all the causes and conditions that make them do whatever we do. But our practice is not a recommendation for tapas practice. We don't starve ourselves down to one grain of rice a day. We don't lie in ditches and let little boys pee on us. Buddha did that. He thought that he could attain enlightenment that way. And when he stopped doing that is when he actually became enlightened. And that's what he chose to share with people, was that, which was the connection I was just talking about. So you don't have to chop off your arm. Please don't chop off your arm. Not a good idea.
But what was his point to refer to that Zen master who cut his arm?
That who lost his arm was the one who finally went to Bodhidharma, who had been sitting for 9 years in a cave, and nobody knew about Zazen. And Bodhidharma wanted everybody to know about it, but his way of showing them was just to do it. And finally, this fellow came along and really, really wanted to know about it. And the story is, and it's a story, it's not true, that he cut off his arm to show his intention. He was so noble and so brave and so much wanted it, that he was willing to sacrifice his arm in order to be told what Bodhidharma was doing. But this is just a way to excite us about doing practice, right? And we don't have to do that.
So I just have one other question. I was just wondering, actually, why do we sit with our eyes open?
We don't have to sit with our eyes open, but it's considered to be more helpful to be connected, even though it's peripheral, that we still have a sense of everything around us, and we don't get lost inside, because when you close your eyes, you can space out so easily. Yeah. Thank you. Well, it's 8 o'clock. So, we have announcements?
Yes. We will have people here next Tuesday night. The door will be open, same as always, at 6. Thanks to Jeffrey and whoever else wants to help me set up. And I am going to send out the schedule tonight or tomorrow to everybody on our Yahoo group list. And if you think you want to, I'll include information in that email of how to notify Jacoji if you're going to join for the meal.
Do you want to share how the meals are done for people who are stopping by?
It's Oreo style, but yes.
It's doable. It's three bowls. And you have to watch what other people are doing, because otherwise you won't understand. And you'll probably make mistakes, because that's one of the points of Oreoke, is to learn how to make a mistake and not be embarrassed. So you serve each other across the table. You serve the person opposite you, and they serve you. And there's chanting that goes with it, and you can just go right along with the flow. It's very easy. And you'll make some mistakes. You'll make mistakes. I make mistakes. It's okay.
One minute.
1 minute sit.